This is Audible.
Recorded Books and One-Click Digital present A Random Walk Down Wall Street, The Time-Tested Strategy for Successful Investing by Burton G. Malkiel. Narrated by George Waddell. Part 1. Stocks and Their Value. Chapter 1. Firm Foundations and Castles in the Air. From Oscar Wilde, Lady Windermere's fan. What is a cynic? A man who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. In this book I will take you on a random walk down Wall Street, providing a guided tour of the complex world of finance and practical advice on investment opportunities and strategies. Many people say that the individual investor has scarcely a chance today against Wall Street's professionals. They point to professional investment strategies using complex derivative instruments and high-frequency trading. They read news reports of accounting fraud, mammoth takeovers, and the activities of well-financed hedge funds. This complexity suggests that there is no longer any room for the individual investor in today's markets. Nothing could be further from the truth. You can do as well as the experts, perhaps even better. It was the steady investors who kept their heads when the stock market tanked in March 2009 and then saw the value of their holdings eventually recover and continue to produce attractive returns. And many of the pros lost their shirts in 2008 buying derivative securities they failed to understand, as well as during the early 2000s when they overloaded their portfolios with overpriced tech stocks. This book is a succinct guide for the individual investor. It covers everything from insurance to income taxes. It tells you how to buy life insurance and how to avoid getting ripped off by banks and brokers. It will even tell you what to do about gold and diamonds. But primarily, it is a book about common stocks, an investment medium that not only provided generous long-run returns in the past, but also appears to represent good possibilities for the years ahead. The Lifecycle Investment Guide, described in Part 4, gives individuals of all age groups specific portfolio recommendations for meeting their financial goals, including advice on how to invest in retirement. What is a random walk? A random walk is one in which future steps or directions cannot be predicted on the basis of past history. When the term is applied to the stock market, it means that short-run changes in stock prices are unpredictable. Investment advisory services, earnings forecasts, and complicated chart patterns are useless. On Wall Street, the term random walk is an obscenity. It is an epithet coined by the academic world and hurled insultingly at the professional soothsayers. Taken to its logical extreme, it means that a blindfolded monkey throwing darts at the stock listings could select a portfolio that would do just as well as one selected by the experts. Now, financial analysts in pinstriped suits do not like being compared to bare-assed apes. They retort that academics are so immersed in equations and Greek symbols, to say nothing of stuffy prose, that they couldn't tell a bull from a bear, even in a china shop. Market professionals arm themselves against the academic onslaught with one of two techniques, called fundamental analysis and technical analysis, which we will examine in Part 2. Academics parry these tactics by obfuscating the random walk theory with three versions, the weak, the semi-strong, and the strong, and by creating their own theory called the new investment technology. This last includes a concept called beta, including smart beta, and I intend to trample on that a bit. By the early 2000s, even some academics had joined the professionals in arguing that the stock market was at least somewhat predictable, after all. Still, as you can see, a tremendous battle is going on, and it's fought with deadly intent, because the stakes are tenure for the academics and bonuses for the professionals. That's why I think you'll enjoy this random walk down Wall Street. It has all the ingredients of high drama, including fortunes made and lost, and classic arguments about their cause. But before we begin, perhaps I should introduce myself and state my qualifications as guide. I have drawn on three aspects of my background in writing this book. Each provides a different perspective on the stock market. First is my professional experience in the fields of investment analysis and portfolio management. I started my career as a market professional with one of Wall Street's leading investment firms. Later, I chaired the investment committee of a multinational insurance company and for many years served as a director of one of the world's largest investment companies. These perspectives have been indispensable to me. Some things in life can never fully be appreciated or understood by a virgin. The same might be said of the stock market. Second are my current positions as an economist and chair of several investment committees. Specializing in securities markets and investment behavior, I have acquired detailed knowledge of academic research and new findings on investment opportunities. Last, and certainly not least, I have been a lifelong investor and successful participant in the market. How successful, I will not say, for it is a peculiarity of the academic world that a professor is not supposed to make money. A professor may inherit lots of money, marry lots of money, and spend lots of money, but he or she is never, never supposed to earn lots of money. It's unacademic. Anyway, teachers are supposed to be dedicated, or so politicians and administrators often say, especially when trying to justify the low academic pay scales. Academics are supposed to be seekers of knowledge, not of financial reward. It is in the former sense, therefore, that I shall tell you of my victories on Wall Street. This book has a lot of facts and figures. Don't let that worry you. It is specifically intended for the financial layperson and offers practical, tested investment advice. You need no prior knowledge to follow it. All you need is the interest and the desire to have your investments work for you. Investing as a way of life today. At this point, it's probably a good idea to explain what I mean by investing and how I distinguish this activity from speculating. I view investing as a method of purchasing assets to gain profit in the form of reasonably predictable income, dividends, interest, or rentals, and or appreciation over the long term. It is the definition of the time period for the investment return and the predictability of the returns that often distinguish an investment from a speculation. A speculator buys stocks hoping for a short-term gain over the next days or weeks. An investor buys stocks likely to produce a dependable future stream of cash returns and capital gains when measured over years or decades. Let me make it quite clear that this is not a book for speculators. I am not going to promise you overnight riches. I'm not promising you stock market miracles. Indeed, a subtitle for this book might well have been the Get Rich Slowly But Surely book. Remember, just to stay even, your investments have to produce a rate of return equal to inflation. Inflation in the United States and throughout most of the developed world fell to 2% or below in the early 2000s, and some analysts believe that relative price stability will continue indefinitely. They suggest that inflation is the exception rather than the rule, and that historical periods of rapid technological progress and peacetime economies were periods of stable or even falling prices. It may well be that little or no inflation will occur during the decades ahead, but I believe investors should not dismiss the possibility that inflation will accelerate again at some time in the future. Although productivity growth accelerated in the 1990s and early 2000s, it has recently slowed, and history tells us that the pace of improvement has always been uneven. Moreover, productivity improvements are harder to come by in some service-oriented activities. It still will take four musicians to play a string quartet and one surgeon to perform an appendectomy throughout the 21st century, and if musicians' and surgeons' salaries rise over time, so will the cost of concert tickets and appendectomies. Thus, upward pressure on prices cannot be dismissed. If inflation were to proceed at a 2-3% rate, a rate much lower than we had in the 1970s and early 1980s, the effect on our purchasing power would still be devastating. The average inflation rate of close to 4% over the 1962-2014 period has yielded the following results. My morning newspaper has risen 4,900%. My afternoon Hershey bar is 20 times more expensive, and it's actually smaller than it was in 1962 when I was in graduate school. If inflation continued at the same rate, Today's morning paper would cost more than $4 by the year 2020. It is clear that if we are to cope with even a mild inflation, we must undertake investment strategies that maintain our real purchasing power. Otherwise, we are doomed to an ever-decreasing standard of living. Investing requires work. Make no mistake about it. Romantic novels are replete with tales of great family fortunes lost through neglect or lack of knowledge on how to care for money. Who can forget the sounds of the cherry orchard being cut down in Chekhov's great play? Free enterprise, not the Marxist system, caused the downfall of the Raneski family. They had not worked to keep their money. Even if you trust all your funds to an investment advisor or to a mutual fund, you still have to know which advisor or which fund is most suitable to handle your money. Armed with the information contained in this book, you should find it a bit easier to make your investment decisions. Most important of all, however, is the fact that investing is fun. It's fun to pit your intellect against that of the vast investment community and to find yourself rewarded with an increase in assets. It's exciting to review your investment returns and to see how they are accumulating at a faster rate than your salary. And it's also stimulating to learn about new ideas for products and services and innovations in the forms of financial investments. A successful investor is generally a well-rounded individual who puts a natural curiosity and an intellectual interest to work. Investing in theory. All investment returns, whether from common stocks or exceptional diamonds, are dependent to varying degrees on future events. That's what makes the fascination of investing. It's a gamble whose success depends on an ability to predict the future. Traditionally, the pros in the investment community have used one of two approaches to asset valuation: the firm foundation theory or the castle in the air theory. Millions of dollars have been gained and lost on these theories. To add to the drama, they appear to be mutually exclusive. An understanding of these two approaches is essential if you are to make sensible investment decisions. It is also a prerequisite for keeping you safe from serious blunders. Toward the end of the 20th century, a third theory, born in academia and named the new investment technology, became popular on the street. Later in the book, I will describe that theory and its application to investment analysis. The firm foundation theory. The firm foundation theory argues that each investment instrument, be it a common stock or a piece of real estate, has a firm anchor of something called intrinsic value, which can be determined by careful analysis of present conditions and future prospects. When market prices fall below or rise above this firm foundation of intrinsic value, a buying or selling opportunity arises because this fluctuation will eventually be corrected, or so the theory goes. Investing then becomes a dull but straightforward matter of comparing something's actual price with its firm foundation of value. It is difficult to ascribe to any one individual the credit for originating the firm foundation theory. S. Eliot Guild is often given this distinction, but the classic development of the technique, and particularly of the nuances associated with it, was worked out by John B. Williams. In The Theory of Investment Value, Williams presented an actual formula for determining the intrinsic value of stock. Williams based his approach on dividend income. In a fiendishly clever attempt to keep things from being simple, he introduced the concept of discounting into the process. Discounting basically involves looking at income backwards. Rather than seeing how much money you will have next year, say $1.05 if you put $1 in a savings certificate at 5% interest, you look at money expected in the future and see how much less it is worth currently. Thus, next year's $1 is worth today only about 95 cents, which could be invested at 5% to produce approximately $1 at that time. Williams actually was serious about this. He went on to argue that the intrinsic value of a stock was equal to the present or discounted value of all its future dividends. Investors were advised to discount the value of monies received later. Because so few people understood it, the term caught on and discounting now enjoys popular usage among investment people. It received a further boost under the aegis of Professor Irving Fisher of Yale, a distinguished economist and investor. The logic of the firm foundation theory is quite respectable and can be illustrated with common stocks. The theory stresses that a stock's value ought to be based on the stream of earnings a firm will be able to distribute in the future in the form of dividends. It stands to reason that the greater the present dividends and their rate of increase, the greater the value of the stock. Thus, differences in growth rates are a major factor in stock valuation. Now the slippery little factor of future expectations sneaks in. Security analysts must estimate not only long-term growth rates, but also how long an extraordinary growth can be maintained. When the market gets overly enthusiastic about how far in the future growth can continue, it is popularly held on Wall Street that stocks are discounting not only the future, but perhaps even the hereafter. The point is that the firm foundation theory relies on some tricky forecasts of the extent and duration of future growth. The foundation of intrinsic value may thus be less dependable than is claimed. The firm foundation theory is not confined to economists alone. Thanks to a very influential book, Benjamin Graham and David Dodd's Security Analysis, a whole generation of Wall Street security analysts was converted to the fold. Sound investment management, the practicing analysts learned, simply consisted of buying securities whose prices were temporarily below intrinsic value and selling ones whose prices were temporarily too high. It was that easy. Of course, instructions for determining intrinsic value were furnished, and any analyst worth his or her salt could calculate it with simple arithmetic. Perhaps the most successful disciple of the Graham and Dodd approach was a canny Midwesterner named Warren Buffett, who is often called the Sage of Omaha. Buffett compiled a legendary investment record, allegedly following the approach of the firm foundation theory. The castle in the air theory. The castle in the air theory of investing concentrates on psychic values. John Maynard Keynes, a famous economist and successful investor, enunciated the theory most lucidly in 1936. It was his opinion that professional investors prefer to devote their energies not to estimating intrinsic values, but rather to analyzing how the crowd of investors is likely to behave in the future and how during periods of optimism they tend to build their hopes into castles in the air. The successful investor tries to beat the gun by estimating what investment situations are most susceptible to public castle building and then buying before the crowd. According to Keynes, the firm foundation theory involves too much work and is of doubtful value. Keynes practiced what he preached. While London's financial men toiled many weary hours in crowded offices, he played the market from his bed for half an hour each morning. This leisurely method of investing earned him several million pounds for his account and a tenfold increase in the market value of the endowment of his college, King's College, Cambridge. In the Depression years in which Keynes gained his fame, most people concentrated on his ideas for stimulating the economy. It was hard for anyone to build castles in the air or to dream that others would. Nevertheless, in his book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, Keynes devoted an entire chapter to the stock market and to the importance of investor expectations. With regard to stocks, Keynes noted that no one knows for sure what will influence future earnings prospects and dividend payments. As a result, he said, most people are largely concerned not with making superior long-term forecasts of the probable yield of an investment over its whole life, but with foreseeing changes in the conventional basis of valuation a short time ahead of the general public. Keynes, in other words, applied psychological principles rather than financial evaluation to the study of the stock market. He wrote, "It is not sensible to pay 25 for an investment of which you believe the prospective yield to justify a value of 30, if you also believe that the market will value it at 20 3 months hence." Keynes described the playing of the stock market in terms readily understandable by his fellow Englishmen. It is analogous to entering a newspaper beauty judging contest, in which one must select the 6 prettiest faces out of 100 photographs, with the prize going to the person whose selections most nearly conform to those of the group as a whole. The smart player recognizes that personal criteria of beauty are irrelevant in determining the contest winner. A better strategy is to select those faces the other players are likely to fancy. This logic tends to snowball. After all, the other participants are likely to play the game with at least as keen a perception. Thus, the optimal strategy is not to pick those faces the player thinks are prettiest, or those the other players are likely to fancy, but rather to predict what the average opinion is likely to be about what the average opinion will be, or to proceed even further along this sequence. So much for British beauty contests. The newspaper contest analogy represents the ultimate form of the castle-in-the-air theory of price determination. An investment is worth a certain price to a buyer because she expects to sell it to someone else at a higher price. The investment, in other words, holds itself up by its own bootstraps. The new buyer, in turn, anticipates that future buyers will assign a still higher value. In this kind of world, a sucker is born every minute, and he exists to buy your investments at a higher price than you paid for them. Any price will do as long as others may be willing to pay more. There is no reason, only mass psychology. All the smart investor has to do is to beat the gun, get in at the very beginning. This theory might less charitably be called the greater fool theory. It's perfectly all right to pay 3 times what something is worth, as long as later on you can find some innocent to pay 5 times what it's worth. The castle-in-the-air theory has many advocates in both the financial and the academic communities. The Nobel laureate Robert Shiller, in his book Irrational Exuberance, argues that the mania in internet and high-tech stocks during the late 1990s can be explained only in terms of mass psychology. At universities, so-called behavioral theories of the stock market, stressing crowd psychology, gained favor during the early 2000s at leading economics departments and business schools across the developed world. The psychologist Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2002 for his seminal contributions to the field of behavioral finance. Earlier, Oscar Morgenstern was a leading champion. Morgenstern argued that the search for intrinsic value in stocks is a search for the will-o'-the-wisp. In an exchange economy, the value of any asset depends on an actual or prospective transaction. He believed that every investor should post the following Latin maxim above his desk: Res tantum valet quantum vendi potest. A thing is worth only what someone else will pay for it. How the random walk is to be conducted. With this introduction out of the way, come join me for a random walk through the investment woods with an ultimate stroll down Wall Street. My first task will be to acquaint you with the historical patterns of pricing and how they bear on the 2 theories of pricing investments. It was Santayana who warned that if we did not learn the lessons of the past, we would be doomed to repeat the same errors. Therefore, I will describe some spectacular crazes, both long past and recently past. Some readers may poo-poo the mad public rush to buy tulip bulbs in the 17th century Netherlands and the 18th century South Sea bubble in England, but no one can disregard the new issue mania of the early 1960s or the nifty-50 craze of the 1970s. The incredible boom in Japanese land and stock prices, and the equally spectacular crash of those prices in the early 1990s, the internet craze of 1999 and early 2000, and the U.S. real estate bubble that ended in 2007 provide continual warnings that neither individuals nor investment professionals are immune from the errors of the past. Chapter 2. The Madness of Crowds. From Mark Twain, Pudd'nhead Wilson. October. This is one of the peculiarly dangerous months to speculate in stocks in. The others are July, January, September, April, November, May, March, June, December, August, and February. Greed run amok has been an essential feature of every spectacular boom in history. In their frenzy, market participants ignore firm foundations of value for the dubious but thrilling assumption that they can make a killing by building castles in the air. Such thinking has enveloped entire nations. The psychology of speculation is a veritable theater of the absurd. Several of its plays are presented in this chapter. The castles that were built during the performances were based on Dutch tulip bulbs, English bubbles, and good old American blue-chip stocks. In each case, some of the people made money some of the time, but only a few emerged unscathed. History in this instance does teach a lesson. Although the castle-in-the-air theory can well explain such speculative binges, outguessing the reactions of a fickle crowd is a most dangerous game. Gustave Le Bon noted in his 1895 classic on crowd psychology, "In crowds, it is stupidity and not mother wit that is accumulated." It would appear that not many have read the book. Skyrocketing markets that depend on purely psychic support have invariably succumbed to the financial law of gravitation. Unsustainable prices may persist for years, but eventually they reverse themselves. Such reversals come with the suddenness of an earthquake, and the bigger the binge, the greater the resulting hangover. Few of the reckless builders of castles in the air have been nimble enough to anticipate these reversals and to escape when everything came tumbling down. The tulip bulb craze. The tulip bulb craze is one of the most spectacular get-rich-quick binges in history. Its excesses become even more vivid when one realizes that it happened in staid old Holland in the early 17th century. The events leading to this speculative frenzy were set in motion in 1593 when a newly appointed botany professor from Vienna brought to Leiden a collection of unusual plants that had originated in Turkey. The Dutch were fascinated with this new addition to the garden, but not with the professor's asking price. He had hoped to sell the bulbs and make a handsome profit. One night a thief broke into the professor's house and stole the bulbs, which were subsequently sold at a lower price but at greater profit. Over the next decade or so, the tulip became a popular but expensive item in Dutch gardens. Many of these flowers succumbed to a non-fatal virus known as mosaic. It was this mosaic that helped to trigger the wild speculation in tulip bulbs. The virus caused the tulip petals to develop contrasting colored stripes, or flames. The Dutch valued highly these infected bulbs called bizarres. In a short time, popular taste dictated that the more bizarre a bulb, the greater the cost of owning it. Slowly, tulip mania set in. At first, bulb merchants simply tried to predict the most popular variegated style for the coming year, much as clothing manufacturers do, engaging the public's taste in fabric, color, and hemlines. Then, they would buy an extra-large stockpile to anticipate a rise in price. Tulip bulb prices began to rise wildly. The more expensive the bulbs became, the more people viewed them as smart investments. Charles Mackay, who chronicled these events in his book, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, noted that the ordinary industry of the country was dropped in favor of speculation in tulip bulbs. Nobles, citizens, farmers, mechanics, seamen, footmen, maidservants, even chimney sweeps and old clotheswomen dabbled in tulips. Everyone imagined that the passion for tulips would last forever. People who said the prices could not possibly go higher watched with chagrin as their friends and relatives made enormous profits. The temptation to join them was hard to resist. In the last years of the tulip spree, which lasted approximately from 1634 to early 1637, people started to barter their personal belongings, such as land, jewels, and furniture, to obtain the bulbs that would make them even wealthier. Bulb prices reached astronomical levels. Part of the genius of financial markets is that when there is a real demand for a method to enhance speculative opportunities, the market will surely provide it. The instruments that enabled tulip speculators to get the most action for their money were call options, similar to those popular today in the stock market. A call option conferred on the holder the right to buy tulip bulbs, call for their delivery, at a fixed price, usually approximating the current market price, during a specified period. He was charged an amount called the option premium, which might run 15% to 20% of the current market price. An option on a tulip bulb currently worth 100 guilders, for example, would cost the buyer only about 20 guilders. If the price moved up to 200 guilders, the option holder would exercise his right. He would buy at 100 and simultaneously sell at the then current price of 200. He then had a profit of 80 guilders, the 100 guilders appreciation less the 20 guilders he paid for the option. Thus, he enjoyed a fourfold increase in his money, whereas an outright purchase would only have doubled his money. Options provide one way to leverage one's investment to increase the potential rewards as well as the risks. Such devices helped to ensure broad participation in the market. The same is true today. The history of the period was filled with tragicomic episodes. One such incident concerned a returning sailor who brought news to a wealthy merchant of the arrival of a shipment of new goods. The merchant rewarded him with a breakfast of fine red herring. Seeing what he thought was an onion on the merchant's counter, and no doubt thinking it very much out of place amid silks and velvets, he proceeded to take it as a relish for his herring. Little did he dream that the onion would have fed a whole ship's crew for a year. It was a costly Semper Augustus tulip bulb. The sailor paid dearly for his relish. His no longer grateful host had him imprisoned for several months on a felony charge. Historians regularly reinterpret the past, and some financial historians, who have re-examined the evidence about various financial bubbles, have argued that considerable rationality in pricing may have existed after all. One of these revisionist historians, Peter Garber, has suggested that tulip bulb pricing in 17th century Holland was far more rational than is commonly believed. Garber makes some good points, and I do not mean to imply that there was no rationality at all in the structure of bulb prices during the period. The Semper Augustus, for example, was a particularly rare and beautiful bulb, and, as Garber reveals, was valued greatly even in the years before the tulip mania. Moreover, Garber's research indicates that rare individual bulbs commanded high prices even after the general collapse of bulb prices, albeit at levels that were only a fraction of their peak prices. But Garber can find no rational explanation for such phenomena as a 20-fold increase in tulip bulb prices during January of 1637, followed by an even larger decline in prices in February. Apparently, as happens in all speculative crazes, prices eventually got so high that some people decided they would be prudent and sell their bulbs. Soon, others followed suit. Like a snowball rolling downhill, bulb deflation grew at an increasingly rapid pace, and in no time at all, panic reigned. Government ministers stated officially that there was no reason for tulip bulbs to fall in price. But no one listened. Dealers went bankrupt and refused to honor their commitments to buy tulip bulbs. A government plan to settle all contracts at 10% of their face value was frustrated when bulbs fell even below this mark, and prices continued to decline. Down and down they went until most bulbs became almost worthless, selling for no more than the price of a common onion. The South Sea Bubble. Suppose your broker has called you and recommended that you invest in a new company with no sales or earnings, just great prospects. What business, you say? I'm sorry, your broker explains. No one must know what the business is, but I can promise you enormous riches. A con game, you say. Right you are, but 300 years ago in England, this was one of the hottest new issues of the period. And, just as you guessed, investors got very badly burned. The story illustrates how fraud can make greedy people even more eager to part with their money. At the time of the South Sea Bubble, the British were ripe for throwing away money. A long period of prosperity had resulted in fat savings and thin investment outlets. In those days, owning stock was considered something of a privilege. As late as 1693, for example, only 499 souls benefited from ownership of East India stock. They reaped rewards in several ways, not least of which was that their dividends were untaxed. Also, their number included women, for stock represented one of the few forms of property that British women could possess in their own right. The South Sea Company, which obligingly filled the need for investment vehicles, had been formed in 1711 to restore faith in the government's ability to meet its obligations. The company took on a government IOU of almost £10 million. As a reward, it was given a monopoly over all trade to the South Seas. The public believed immense riches were to be made in such trade and regarded the stock with distinct favor. From the very beginning, the South Sea Company reaped profits at the expense of others. Holders of the government securities, to be assumed by the company, simply exchanged their securities for those of the South Sea Company. Those with prior knowledge of the plan quietly bought up government securities, selling as low as £55, and then turned them in at par for £100 worth of South Sea stock when the company was incorporated. Not a single director of the company had the slightest experience in South American trade. This did not stop them from quickly outfitting African slave ships, the sale of slaves being one of the most lucrative features of South American trade. But even this venture did not prove profitable because the mortality rate on the ships was so high. The directors were, however, wise in the art of public appearance. An impressive house in London was rented, and the boardroom was furnished with 30 black Spanish upholstered chairs whose beechwood frames and gilt nails made them handsome to look at but uncomfortable to sit in. In the meantime, a shipload of company wool that was desperately needed in Veracruz was sent instead to Cartagena, where it rotted on the wharf for lack of buyers. Still, the stock of the company held its own and even rose modestly over the next few years despite the dilutive effect of bonus stock dividends and a war with Spain that led to a temporary collapse in trading opportunities. John Carswell, the author of an excellent history, The South Sea Bubble, wrote of John Blunt, a director and one of the prime promoters of the securities of the South Sea Company, that he continued to live his life with a prayer book in his right hand and a prospectus in his left, never letting his right hand know what his left hand was doing. Across the channel, another company was formed by an exiled Englishman named John Law. Law's goal in life was to replace metal as money and create more liquidity through a national paper currency. Bitcoin promoters are following a long tradition. To further his purpose, Law acquired a derelict concern called the Mississippi Company and proceeded to build a conglomerate that became one of the largest capital enterprises ever to exist. The Mississippi Company attracted speculators and their money from throughout the continent. The word millionaire was invented at this time, and no wonder. The price of Mississippi stock rose from £100 to £2,000 in just 2 years, even though there was no logical reason for such an increase. At one time, the inflated total market value of the stock of the Mississippi Company in France was more than 80 times that of all the gold and silver in the country. Meanwhile, back on the English side of the channel, a bit of jingoism now began to appear in some of the great English houses. Why should all the money be going to the French Mississippi Company? What did England have to counter this? The answer was the South Sea Company, whose prospects were beginning to look a bit better, especially with the news that there would be peace with Spain, and hence the way to the South American trade would at last be clear. Mexicans supposedly were waiting for the opportunity to empty their gold mines in return for England's abundant supply of cotton and woolen goods. This was free enterprise at its finest. In 1720, the directors, an avaricious lot, decided to capitalize on their reputation by offering to fund the entire national debt, amounting to £31 million. This was boldness indeed, and the public loved it. When a bill to that effect was introduced in Parliament, the stock promptly rose from £130 to £300. Various friends and backers who had shown interest in getting the bill passed were rewarded with free stock grants that could be sold back to the company when the price went up, with the individual collecting the profit. Among those rewarded were George I's mistress and her nieces, all of whom bore a startling resemblance to the king. On April 12, 1720, 5 days after the bill became law, the South Sea Company sold a new issue of stock at £300. The issue could be bought on the installment plan, £60 down, and the rest in 8 easy payments. Even the king could not resist. He subscribed for stock totaling £100,000. Fights broke out among other investors surging to buy. To ease the public appetite, the South Sea directors announced another new issue, this one at £400. But the public was ravenous. Within a month, the stock was £550. On June 15th, yet another issue was floated. This time, the payment plan was even easier, 10% down, and not another payment for a year. The stock hit £800. Half the House of Lords and more than half the House of Commons signed on. Eventually, the price rose to £1,000. The speculative craze was in full bloom. Not even the South Sea Company was capable of handling the demands of all the fools who wanted to be parted from their money. Investors looked for other new ventures where they could get in on the ground floor. Just as speculators today search for the next Google, so in England, in the early 1700s, they looked for the next South Sea Company. Promoters obliged by organizing and bringing to the market a flood of new issues to meet the insatiable craving for investment. As the days passed, new financing proposals ranged from ingenious to absurd, from importing a large number of jackasses from Spain, even though there was an abundant supply in England, to making salt water fresh. Increasingly, the promotions involved some element of fraud, such as making boards out of sawdust. There were nearly 100 different projects, each more extravagant and deceptive than the other, but each offering the hope of immense gain. They soon received the name of Bubbles, as appropriate a name as could be devised. Like bubbles, they popped quickly, usually within a week or so. The public, it seemed, would buy anything. New companies seeking financing during this period were organized for such purposes as the building of ships against pirates, encouraging the breeding of horses in England, trading in human hair, building hospitals for bastard children, extracting silver from lead, extracting sunlight from cucumbers, and even producing a wheel of perpetual motion. The prize, however, must surely go to the unknown soul who started a company for carrying on an undertaking of great advantage, but nobody to know what it is. The prospectus promised unheard-of rewards. At 9 o'clock in the morning, when the subscription books opened, crowds of people from all walks of life practically beat down the door in an effort to subscribe. Within 5 hours, 1,000 investors handed over their money for shares in the company. Not being greedy himself, the promoter promptly closed up shop and set off for the continent. He was never heard from again. Not all investors in the bubble companies believed in the feasibility of the schemes to which they subscribed. People were too sensible for that. They did believe, however, in the greater fool theory, that prices would rise, that buyers would be found, and that they would make money. Thus, most investors considered their actions the height of rationality, expecting that they could sell their shares at a premium in the aftermarket, that is, the trading market in the shares after their initial issue. Whom the gods would destroy, they first ridicule. Signs that the end was near appeared with the issuance of a pack of South Sea playing cards. Each card contained a caricature of a bubble company with an appropriate verse inscribed underneath. One of these, the Puckle Machine Company, was supposed to produce machines discharging both round and square cannonballs and bullets. Puckle claimed that his machine would revolutionize the art of war. It was described as follows. A rare invention to destroy the crowd of fools at home instead of foes abroad. Fear not, my friends, this terrible machine. They're only wounded that have shares therein. Many individual bubbles have been pricked without dampening the speculative enthusiasm. but the deluge came in August with an irreparable puncture to the South Sea Company. Realizing that the price of the shares in the market bore no relationship to the real prospects of the company, the directors and officers sold out in the summer. The news leaked, and the stock fell. Soon, the price of the shares collapsed, and panic reigned. Government officials tried in vain to restore confidence, and a complete collapse of the public credit was barely averted. Similarly, the price of Mississippi Company shares fell to a pittance as the public realized that an excess of paper currency creates no real wealth, only inflation. Big losers in the South Sea bubble included Isaac Newton, who exclaimed, "I can calculate the motions of heavenly bodies, but not the madness of people." So much for castles in the air. To protect the public from further abuses, Parliament passed the Bubble Act, which forbade the issuing of stock certificates by companies. For more than a century, until the Act was repealed in 1825, there were relatively few share certificates in the British market. Wall Street lays an egg. The bulbs and bubbles are, admittedly, ancient history. Could the same sort of thing happen in more modern times? Let's turn to more recent events. America, the land of opportunity, had its turn in the 1920s. And given our emphasis on freedom and growth, we produced one of the most spectacular booms and loudest crashes civilization has ever known. Conditions could not have been more favorable for a speculative craze. The country had been experiencing unrivaled prosperity. One could not but have faith in American business, and as Calvin Coolidge said, "The business of America is business." Businessmen were likened to religious missionaries and almost deified. Such analogies were even made in the opposite direction. Bruce Barton of the New York advertising agency Batten, Barton, Durston, and Osborne wrote in The Man Nobody Knows that Jesus was the first businessman and that his parables were the most powerful advertisements of all time. In 1928, stock market speculation became a national pastime. From early March 1928 through early September 1929, the market's percentage increase equaled that of the entire period from 1923 through early 1928. Stock prices of major industrial corporations sometimes rose 10 or 15 points per day. Not everybody was speculating in the market. Borrowing to buy stocks, buying on margin, did increase from $1 billion in 1921 to almost $9 billion in 1929. Nevertheless, only about 1 million people owned stocks on margin in 1929. Still, the speculative spirit was at least as widespread as in the previous crazes and was certainly unrivaled in its intensity. More important, stock market speculation was central to the culture. John Brooks, in Once in Golconda, recounted the remarks of a British correspondent newly arrived in New York. "You could talk about Prohibition, or Hemingway, or air conditioning, or music, or horses, but in the end, you had to talk about the stock market, and that was when the conversation became serious." Golconda, now in ruins, was a city in India. According to legend, everyone who passed through it became rich. Unfortunately, there were hundreds of smiling operators only too glad to help the public construct castles in the air. Manipulation on the stock exchange set new records for unscrupulousness. No better example can be found than the operation of investment pools. One such undertaking raised the price of RCA stock 61 points in 4 days. An investment pool required close cooperation on the one hand and complete disdain for the public on the other. Generally, such operations began when a number of traders banded together to manipulate a particular stock. They appointed a pool manager, who justifiably was considered something of an artist, and promised not to double-cross each other through private operations. The pool manager accumulated a large block of stock through inconspicuous buying over a period of weeks. If possible, he also obtained an option to buy a substantial block of stock at the current market price. Next, he tried to enlist the stock's exchange specialist as an ally. Pool members were in the swim with the specialist on their side. A stock exchange specialist functions as a broker's broker. If a stock was trading at $50 a share, and you gave your broker an order to buy at $45, the broker typically left that order with the specialist. If and when the stock fell to $45, the specialist then executed the order. All such orders to buy below the market price or sell above it were kept in the specialist's supposedly private book. Now you see why the specialist could be so valuable to the pool manager. The book gave information about the extent of existing orders to buy and sell at prices below and above the current market. It was always helpful to know as many of the cards of the public payers as possible. Now, the real fun was ready to begin. Generally, at this point, the pool manager had members of the pool trade among themselves. For example, Haskell sells 200 shares to Sydney at 40, and Sydney sells them back at 40 and an eighth. The process is repeated with 400 shares at prices of 40 and a quarter and 40 and a half. Next comes the sale of a 1,000-share block at 40 and five-eighths, followed by another at 40 and three-quarters. These sales were recorded on ticker tapes across the country, and the illusion of activity was conveyed to the thousands of tape watchers who crowded into the brokerage offices of the country. Such activity, generated by so-called wash sales, created the impression that something big was afoot. Now, tip sheet writers and market commentators under the control of the pool manager would tell of exciting developments in the offing. The pool manager also tried to ensure that the flow of news from the company's management was increasingly favorable. If all went well, and in the speculative atmosphere of the 1928-29 period it could hardly miss, the combination of tape activity and managed news would bring the public in. Once the public came in, the free-for-all started, and it was time discreetly to pull the plug. As the public did the buying, the pool did the selling. The pool manager began feeding stock into the market, first slowly and then in larger and larger blocks, before the public could collect its senses. At the end of the roller coaster ride, the pool members had netted large profits, and the public was left holding the suddenly deflated stock. But people didn't have to band together to defraud the public. Many individuals, particularly corporate officers and directors, did quite well on their own. Take Albert Wiggin, the head of Chase, the nation's second-largest bank at the time. In July 1929, Mr. Wiggin became apprehensive about the dizzy heights to which stocks had climbed and no longer felt comfortable speculating on the bull side of the market. He was rumored to have made millions in a pool boosting the price of his own bank. Believing that the prospects for his own bank's stock were particularly dim, he sold short more than 42,000 shares of Chase stock. Selling short is a way to make money if the stock prices fall. It involves selling stock you do not currently own in the expectation of buying it back later at a lower price. It's hoping to buy low and sell high, but in reverse order. Wiggin's timing was perfect. Immediately after the short sale, the price of Chase stock began to fall. And when the crash came in the fall, the stock dropped precipitously. When the account was closed in November, he had netted a multi-million-dollar profit from the operation. Conflicts of interest apparently did not trouble Mr. Wiggin. In fairness, it should be pointed out that he did retain a net ownership position in Chase stock during this period. Nevertheless, the rules in existence today would not allow an insider to make short-swing profits from trading his own stock. On September 3, 1929, the market averages reached a peak that was not to be surpassed for a quarter of a century. The endless chain of prosperity was soon to break. General business activity had already turned down months before. Prices drifted for the next day, and on the following day, September 5, the market suffered a sharp decline known as the Babson Break. This was named in honor of Roger Babson, a frail, goateed, pixie-ish-looking financial advisor from Wellesley, Massachusetts. At a financial luncheon that day, he had said, "I repeat what I said at this time last year and the year before, that sooner or later, a crash is coming." Wall Street professionals greeted the new pronouncements from the Sage of Wellesley, as he was known, with their usual derision. As Babson implied, he had been predicting the crash for several years, and he had yet to be proven right. Nevertheless, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, when Babson's words were quoted on the broad tape, the Dow Jones Financial News tape, which was an essential part of the furniture in every brokerage house, the market went into a nosedive. In the last frantic hour of trading, American Telephone and Telegraph went down 6 points, Westinghouse 7 points, and U.S. Steel 9 points. It was a prophetic episode. After the Babson break, the possibility of a crash, which was entirely unthinkable a month before, suddenly became a common subject for discussion. Confidence faltered. September had many more bad than good days. At times, the market fell sharply. Bankers and government officials assured the country that there was no cause for concern. Professor Irving Fisher of Yale, one of the progenitors of the intrinsic value theory, offered his soon-to-be immortal opinion that stocks had reached what looked like a permanently high plateau. By Monday, October 21st, the stage was set for a classic stock market break. The declines in stock prices had led to calls for more collateral from margin customers. Unable or unwilling to meet the calls, these customers were forced to sell their holdings. This depressed prices and led to more margin calls and finally to a self-sustaining selling wave. The volume of sales on October 21st zoomed to more than 6 million shares. The ticker fell way behind, to the dismay of the tens of thousands of individuals watching the tape from brokerage houses around the country. Nearly an hour and 40 minutes had elapsed after the close of the market before the last transaction was actually recorded on the stock ticker. The indomitable Fisher dismissed the decline as a shaking out of the lunatic fringe that attempts to speculate on margin. He went on to say that prices of stocks during the boom had not caught up with their real value and would go higher. Among other things, the professor believed that the market had not yet reflected the beneficent effects of prohibition, which had made the American worker more productive and dependable. On October 24th, later called Black Thursday, the market volume reached almost 13 million shares. Prices sometimes fell $5 and $10 on each trade. Many issues dropped 40 and 50 points during a couple of hours. On the next day, Herbert Hoover offered his famous diagnosis. The fundamental business of the country is on a sound and prosperous basis. Tuesday, October 29th, 1929, was among the most catastrophic days in the history of the New York Stock Exchange. Only October 19th and 20th, 1987, rivaled in intensity the panic on the exchange. More than 16.4 million shares were traded on that day in 1929. A 16 million share day in 1929 would be equivalent to a multi-billion share day in 2014 because of the greater number of listed shares. Prices fell almost perpendicularly and kept on falling. With the exception of safe AT&T, which lost only three-quarters of its value, most blue-chip stocks had fallen 95% or more by the time the lows were reached in 1932. Perhaps the best summary of the debacle was given by Variety, the show business weekly which headlined the story, Wall Street Lays an Egg. The speculative boom was dead, and billions of dollars of share values, as well as the dreams of millions, were wiped out. The crash in the stock market was followed by the most devastating depression in history. Again, there are revisionist historians who say there was a method to the madness of the stock market boom of the late 1920s. Harold Bierman, Jr., for example, in his book, The Great Myths of 1929, has suggested that without perfect foresight, stocks were not obviously overpriced in 1929. After all, very intelligent people such as Irving Fisher and John Maynard Keynes believed that stocks were reasonably priced. Bierman goes on to argue that the extreme optimism undergirding the stock market might even have been justified had it not been for inappropriate monetary policies. The crash itself, in his view, was precipitated by the Federal Reserve Board's policy of raising interest rates to punish speculators. There are at least grains of truth in Bierman's arguments, and economists today often blame the severity of the 1930s depression on the Federal Reserve for allowing the money supply to decline sharply. Nevertheless, history teaches us that very sharp increases in stock prices are seldom followed by a gradual return to relative price stability. Even if prosperity had continued into the 1930s, stock prices could never have sustained their advance of the late 1920s. In addition, the anomalous behavior of closed-end investment company shares, which I will cover in Chapter 15, provides clinching evidence of wide-scale stock market irrationality during the 1920s. The fundamental value of these closed-end funds consists of the market value of the securities they hold. In most periods since 1930, these funds have sold at discounts of 10 to 20% from their asset values. From January to August 1929, however, the typical closed-end fund sold at a premium of 50%. Moreover, the premiums for some of the best-known funds were astronomical. Goldman Sachs Trading Corporation sold at twice its net asset value. Tricontinental Corporation sold at 256% of its asset value. This meant that you could go to your broker and buy, say, AT&T at whatever its market price was, or you would purchase it through the fund at 2.5 times the market value. It was irrational, speculative enthusiasm that drove the prices of these funds far above the value at which their individual security holdings could be purchased. An afterword. Why are memories so short? Why do such speculative crazes seem so isolated from the lessons of history? I have no apt answer, but I am convinced that Bernard Baruch was correct in suggesting that a study of these events can help equip investors for survival. The consistent losers in the market, from my personal experience, are those who are unable to resist being swept up in some kind of tulip bulb craze. It is not hard to make money in the market. What is hard to avoid is the alluring temptation to throw your money away on short, get-rich-quick speculative binges. It is an obvious lesson, but one frequently ignored. Chapter 3. Speculative Bubbles from the 60s into the 90s. From Lewis Carroll, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. Everything's got a moral, if only you can find it. The madness of the crowd can be truly spectacular. The examples I have just cited, plus a host of others, have persuaded more and more people to put their money under the care of professional portfolio managers, those who run the large pension and retirement funds, mutual funds, and investment counseling organizations. Although the crowd may be mad, the institution is above all that. Very well, let us then take a look at the sanity of institutions. The sanity of institutions. By the 1990s, institutions accounted for more than 90% of the trading volume on the New York Stock Exchange. One would think that the hard-headed, sharp-penciled reasoning of the pros would guarantee that the extravagant excesses of the past would no longer exist. And yet professional investors participated in several distinct speculative movements from the 1960s through the 1990s. In each case, professional institutions bid actively for stocks not because they felt such stocks were undervalued under the firm foundation principle, but because they anticipated that some greater fools would take the shares off their hands at even more inflated prices. Because these speculative movements relate to present-day markets, I think you'll find this institutional tour especially useful. The Soaring 60s. The New Era. The Growth Stock New Issue Craze. We start our journey when I did, in 1959, when I had just gone to Wall Street. Growth was the magic word in those days, taking on an almost mystical significance. Growth companies such as IBM and Texas Instruments sold at price-earning multiples of more than 80. A year later, they sold at multiples in the 20s and 30s. Questioning the propriety of such valuations became almost heretical. Though these prices could not be justified on firm foundation principles, investors believed that buyers would still eagerly pay even higher prices. Lord Keynes must have smiled quietly from wherever it is that economists go when they die. I recall vividly one of the senior partners of my firm shaking his head and admitting that he knew of no one with any recollection of the 1929-32 crash who would buy and hold the high-priced growth stocks. But the Young Turks held sway. Newsweek quoted one broker as saying that speculators have the idea that anything they buy will double overnight. The horrible thing is, it has happened. More was to come. Promoters, eager to satisfy the insatiable thirst of investors for the space-age stocks of the soaring 60s, created more new issues in the 1959-62 period than at any previous time in history. The new issue mania rivaled the South Sea bubble in its intensity and also, regrettably, in the fraudulent practices that were revealed. It was called the Tronics boom, because the stock offerings often included some garbled version of the word electronics in their title, even if the companies had nothing to do with the electronics industry. Buyers of these issues didn't really care what the companies made, so long as it sounded electronic, with a suggestion of the esoteric. For example, American Music Guild, whose business consisted entirely of the door-to-door sale of phonograph records and players, changed its name to Space Tone before going public. The shares were sold to the public at 2 and within a few weeks rose to 14. Jack Dreyfuss of Dreyfuss & Company commented on the mania as follows. Take a nice little company that's been making shoelaces for 40 years and sells at a respectable 6x earnings ratio. Change the name from Shoelaces Incorporated to Electronics and Silicon Firth Burners. In today's market, the words electronics and silicon are worth 15x earnings. However, the real play comes from the word Firth Burners, which no one understands. A word that no one understands entitles you to double your entire score. Therefore, we have 6x earnings for the shoelace business and 15x earnings for electronic and silicon, or a total of 21x earnings. Multiply this by 2 for Firth Burners, and we now have a score of 42x earnings for the new company. Let the following examples tell the story. Security, Boonton Electronic Corporation. Offering date, March 6, 1961. Offering price, 5.5. Bid price on first day of trading, 12.25. High bid price, 1961, 24.5. Low bid price, 1962, 1.625. Geophysics Corporation. Offering date, December 8, 1960. Offering price, 14. Bid price on first day of trading, 27. High bid price, 1961, 58. Low bid price, 1962, 9. Hydrospace Technology. Offering date, July 19, 1960. Offering price, 3. Bid price on first day of trading, 7. High bid price, 1961, 7. Low bid price, 1962, 1. Mother's Cookie Corporation. Offering date, March 8, 1961. Offering price, 15. Bid price on first day of trading, 23. High bid price, 1961, 25. Low bid price, 1962, 7. Even Mother's Cookie could count on a sizable gain. Think of the glory it could have achieved if it had called itself Mothertron's Cookitronics. 10 years later, the shares of most of these companies were almost worthless. Today, none exist. Where was the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, all this time? Aren't new issuers required to register their offerings with the SEC? Can't they and their underwriters be punished for false and misleading statements? Yes, the SEC was there, but by law it had to stand by quietly. As long as a company has prepared and distributed to investors an adequate prospectus, the SEC can do nothing to save buyers from themselves. For example, many of the prospectuses of the period contained the following type of warning in bold letters on the cover. Warning: this company has no assets or earnings and will be unable to pay dividends in the foreseeable future. The shares are highly risky. But just as the warnings on packs of cigarettes do not prevent many people from smoking, so the warning that this investment may be dangerous to your wealth cannot block a speculator from forking over his money. The SEC can warn fools, but it cannot keep them from parting with their money. And the buyers of new issues were so convinced the stocks would rise in price that the underwriter's problem was not how he could sell the shares, but how to allocate them among the frenzied purchasers. Fraud and market manipulation are different matters. Here, the SEC can take and has taken strong action. Indeed, many of the little-known brokerage houses on the fringes of respectability, which were responsible for most of the new issues and for manipulation of their prices, were suspended for a variety of peculations. The Tronix boom came back to earth in 1962. Yesterday's hot issue became today's cold turkey. Many professionals refused to accept the fact that they had speculated recklessly. Very few pointed out that it is always easy to look back and say when prices were too high or too low. Fewer still said that no one seems to know the proper price for a stock at any given time. Synergy generates energy. The conglomerate boom. Part of the genius of the financial market is that if a product is demanded, it is produced. The product that all investors desired was expected growth in earnings per share. If growth couldn't be found in a name, it was a good bet that someone would find another way to produce it. By the mid-1960s, creative entrepreneurs suggested that growth could be created by synergism. Synergism is the quality of having 2 + 2 = 5. Thus, two separate companies with an earning power of $2 million each might produce combined earnings of $5 million if the businesses were consolidated. This magical, surefire new creation was called a conglomerate. Although antitrust laws at that time kept large companies from purchasing firms in the same industry, it was possible to purchase firms in other industries without Justice Department interference. The consolidations were carried out in the name of synergism. Ostensibly, the conglomerate would achieve higher sales and earnings than would have been possible for the independent entities alone. In fact, the major impetus for the conglomerate wave of the 1960s was that the acquisition process itself could be made to produce growth in earnings per share. Indeed, the managers of conglomerates tended to possess financial expertise rather than the operating skills required to improve the profitability of the acquired companies. By an easy bit of legerdemain, they could put together a group of companies with no basic potential at all and produce steadily rising per-share earnings. The following example shows how this monkey business was performed. Suppose we have two companies, the Able Circuit Smasher Company, an electronics firm, and Baker Candy Company, which makes chocolate bars. Each has 200,000 shares outstanding. It's 1965, and both companies have earnings of $1 million a year, or $5 per share. Let's assume that neither business is growing, and that, with or without merger activity, earnings would just continue along at the same level. The two firms sell at different prices, however. Because Able Circuit Smasher Company is in the electronics business, the market awards it a price-earnings multiple of 20, which, multiplied by its $5 earnings per share, gives it a market price of $100. Baker Candy Company, in a less glamorous business, has its earnings multiplied at only 10 times, and, consequently, its $5 per share earnings command a market price of only $50. The management of Able Circuit would like to become a conglomerate. It offers to absorb Baker by swapping stock at the rate of 2 for 3. The holders of Baker shares would get 2 shares of Able stock, which have a market value of $200, for every 3 shares of Baker stock, with a total market value of $150. Clearly, Baker's stockholders are likely to accept cheerfully. We have a budding conglomerate, newly named Synergon, Incorporated, which now has 333,333 shares outstanding and total earnings of $2 million to put against them, or $6 per share. Thus, by 1966, when the merger has been completed, we find that earnings have risen by 20%, from $5 to $6, and this growth seems to justify Able's former price-earnings multiple of 20. Consequently, the shares of Synergon, nay, Able, rise from $100 to $120, and everyone goes home rich and happy. In addition, the shareholders of Baker, who are bought out, need not pay any taxes on their profits until they sell their shares of the combined company. A year later, Synergon finds Charlie Company, which earns $10 per share, or $1 million with 100,000 shares outstanding. Charlie Company is in the relatively risky military hardware business, so its shares command a multiple of only 10 and sell at $100. Synergon offers to absorb Charlie Company on a share-for-share exchange basis. Charlie's shareholders are delighted to exchange their $100 shares for the conglomerate's $120 shares. By the end of 1967, the combined company has $3 million in earnings, 433,333 shares outstanding, and $6.92 of earnings per share. Here we have a case where the conglomerate has literally manufactured growth. None of the three companies was growing at all. Yet, simply by virtue of their merger, our conglomerate will show the following earnings growth. Earnings per share, Synergon Incorporated, 1965, $5. 1966, $6. 1967, $6.92. Synergon is a growth stock, and its record of extraordinary performance appears to have earned it a high and possibly even an increasing multiple of earnings. The trick that makes the game work is the ability of the electronics company to swap its high multiple stock for the stock of another company with a lower multiple. The candy company can sell its earnings only at a multiple of 10. But when these earnings are averaged with those of the electronics company, the total earnings, including those from selling chocolate bars, could be sold at a multiple of 20. And the more acquisitions Synergon could make, the faster earnings per share would grow, and thus the more attractive the stock would look to justify its high multiple. The whole thing is like a chain letter. No one would get hurt as long as the growth of acquisitions proceeded exponentially. Although the process could not continue for long, the possibilities were mind-boggling for those who got in at the start. It seems difficult to believe that Wall Street professionals could fall for the conglomerate con game, but accept it they did for a period of several years. Or perhaps as subscribers to the castle-in-the-air theory, they only believed that other people would fall for it. Automatic Sprinkler Corporation, later called ATO Incorporated, and later still at the urging of its modest chief executive officer, Mr. Figge, Figge International, is a real example of how the game of manufacturing growth was actually played. Between 1963 and 1968, the company's sales volume rose by more than 1,400%, a phenomenal record due solely to acquisitions. In the middle of 1967, four mergers were completed in a 25-day period. These newly acquired companies, all selling at relatively low price earnings multiples, helped to produce a sharp growth in earnings per share. The market responded to this growth by bidding up the price earnings multiple to more than 50 times earnings in 1967, and the company's stock price from about $8 per share in 1963 to $73.58 in 1967. Mr. Figge, the president of Automatic Sprinkler, performed the public relations job necessary to help Wall Street build its castle in the air. He automatically sprinkled his conversations with talismanic phrases about the energy of the free-form company and its interface with change and technology. He was careful to point out that he looked at 20 to 30 deals for each one he bought. Wall Street loved every word of it. Mr. Figge was not alone in conning Wall Street. Managers of other conglomerates almost invented a new language in the process of dazzling the investment community. They talked about market matrices, core technology fulcrums, modular building blocks, and the nucleus theory of growth. No one from Wall Street really knew what the words meant, but they all got the nice, warm feeling of being in the technological mainstream. Conglomerate managers also found a new way of describing the businesses they had bought. Their shipbuilding businesses became marine systems. Zinc mining became the space minerals division. Steel fabrication plants became the materials technology division. A lighting fixture or lock company became part of the protective services division. And if one of the ungentlemanly security analysts, somebody from City College of New York rather than Harvard Business School, had the nerve to ask how you can get 15 to 20% growth from a foundry or a meatpacker, he was told that efficiency experts had isolated millions of dollars of excess costs, that marketing research had found several fresh, uninhabited markets, and that profit margins could be easily tripled within 2 years. Instead of going down with merger activity, the price earnings multiples of conglomerate stocks rose for a while. The music slowed drastically for the conglomerates on January 19, 1968, when the granddaddy of the conglomerates, Litton Industries, announced that earnings for the second quarter of that year would be substantially less than had been forecast. It had recorded 20% yearly increases for almost a decade. The market had so thoroughly come to believe in alchemy that the announcement was greeted with disbelief and shock. In the selling wave that followed, conglomerate stocks declined by roughly 40% before a feeble recovery set in. Worse was to come. In July, the Federal Trade Commission announced that it would make an in-depth investigation of the conglomerate merger movement. Again, the stocks went tumbling down. The SEC and the accounting profession finally made their move and began to make attempts to clarify the reporting techniques for mergers and acquisitions. The sell orders came flooding in. Shortly afterwards, the SEC and the U.S. Assistant Attorney General in charge of antitrust indicated a strong concern about the accelerating pace of the merger movement. The aftermath of this speculative phase revealed two disturbing factors. First, conglomerates could not always control their far-flung empires. Indeed, investors became disenchanted with the conglomerate's new math. 2 plus 2 certainly did not equal 5, and some investors wondered whether it even equaled 4.